Welcome to the Sex Talk Cafe, a podcast where you'll get to learn from the experts in the field of sex, love, and relationships. The mission of the Sex Talk Cafe is to normalize the conversation on sexuality while building a bridge between the sexual and spiritual. I'm your host, Susan Morgan Taylor. I'm a holistic sex therapist, intuitive coach, and specialist in women's sexuality and feminine spirituality. I'm the founder and CEO of the Pathway to Pleasure Collective, where I help women and couples around the world restore intimacy, save their relationship, and get back to love without feeling like they have to sacrifice themselves just to keep their partner happy. Thank you so much for joining me. Welcome to the Sex Talk Cafe. All right, everybody, welcome to Sex Talk Cafe. And I am really, really excited about my guest today here on the show. We have Dr. Jolie Hamilton, who is an expert in non-monogamous relationships and helping couples really successfully open up and deal with some of the really challenging things that happen when a couple decides to do that. And so I am very excited to have this conversation because personally, I've seen people really do this really poorly. And it can really cause a big mess. So Jolie, welcome to the Sex Talk Cafe.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Susan. It is always a joy to talk about it. And yes, you're right. It can get really messy. It's easy to do something new poorly.
Yes. Yeah. Well, tell our listeners maybe first just a little bit about you and your work. And then I would love to hear a little bit about your personal story and how you got into this. But first, just sort of maybe an overview of who you are, what you do.
Yeah. Well, I am a depth psychologist. My PhD is in Jungian and archetypal psychology. So while I also have a master's in mental health counseling, I really love the stuff that asks us to examine deeply, like what our imagination has within it, where our individuation path is leading. So that's my basis, my formal academic basis. I'm also a certified sexuality educator. Love that work as well. And it all intermingles. I'm also a mom of 7 kids, and so how I move in the world is also really attached to being a mother and having a life that looks quite plain vanilla on the outside. And then on the inside, I'm like, yeah, I'm also a kinky, polyamorous, queer person who's existing in a world that wasn't exactly designed for me. So that mess is me. And my research is in jealousy. My primary academic research is in jealousy. And I love talking about jealousy because it is part of why people say, I can't do this well. I can't open up. I couldn't consider that. It's also one of the things that I think monogamous and non-monogamous people can learn from each other when we talk about jealousy. So I think that's a great intersection of my work.
Yes. And I know that that's a really big piece of what we're going to talk about today. And really, like, you have, the deep wisdom of jealousy is kind of one of your topics. And I think that a lot of times rarely are we ever taught to think about a quote unquote negative emotion as something that contains deep wisdom, and especially something like jealousy, which is so inherently uncomfortable to experience. I love that this is like your main area of study, of research, and I love that you have some wisdom that you can share with our listeners today about that. But I'd be really curious to see, how did you come upon this? And like, it's such an interesting area of work and research and such a very specific niche. Can you tell our listeners just about your personal story and how you came into this line of work?
Yeah, so I lived a very straightforward, mono-normative life. I got engaged at 17, way too young, married at 20, and then popped out a baby every 2.5 years through my 20s, and woke up one day at 32 and was like, things are not right. Things aren't right. And I had discovered that there was this thing called open relationships only very recently. I was very cloistered in my 20s. I really didn't know what was going on. I knew I had fallen in love with multiple people, but I didn't know people were out there living that life. So when some of my friends were exploring and experimenting at the edges of, like, what is it to be open? It opened my imagination. And my personal way of doing things is to jump in with both feet. And so I did. I jumped in. It was a hot mess, honestly. I did everything wrong. And this is 15 years ago. We had just the ethical slut. Very few resources out there. And I didn't know what I didn't know. And that's why I studied my way out. I actually went back to school. I got a bachelor's, a master's, a PhD, then another master's, and a bunch of certifications, because for me, figuring out how to love multiply meant figuring out how to do relationships, including the relationship to myself, beautifully.
Wow.
It's complicated. And so for me, it started with the books and then really became about how do I translate that into my actions in my day-to-day life.
I love it. And just for our listeners who don't know, The Ethical Slut is a book on open relationships, just for anyone didn't know that reference. And I love what you're saying, because I think there's sort of this, and especially in this day and age, I think the non-monogamy thing is really front and center, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's kind of like this trend, it's really starting to take a sort of a new place, I think, out there as an option for a lot of couples. But I think that there can also kind of be this sort of romantic idea about it. And people do not realize that, like, you actually need more relationship skills, more communication skills, not just with others, but like you said, like a clarity of your relationship with yourself. And could you talk a little bit about that? How does that show up and what does that mean? And how is this piece a really critical part of opening a relationship successfully?
Yeah. So I call myself the coach for couples who color outside the lines, because it's right there when you're like, I'm going to remake this picture. I'm going to draw my own lines. That's when people often discover, oh, I actually have no idea where the lines are. I don't actually know what I want. I don't know what I need. And on top of that, my relationship functions only so far as I have thought to examine it. And so monogamy, I wouldn't say that monogamy is simpler, but I would say default compulsory monogamy that's lived unconsciously can give us the illusion of simplicity. And a lot of us live that way for a long time. I did. I lived with blinders on, and I did not know where I wasn't having a really successful, thriving relationship, even though from the outside, it certainly looked that way. And from the inside, I could convince myself that we were doing okay. When we want to open up, there is often a romanticization of, okay, whatever isn't working in my current relationships, I'll do it better because now I'll have multiple people to meet my needs. Yeah, you'll also have multiple relationships to manage, and you're going to be in the position of dealing with conflicting needs and inner conflict. And a lot of us, I know I count myself amongst those people, dealing with inner conflict is incredibly difficult. I can find myself unable to function in my relationships when I don't actually know where I stand. So open relating really opens us up to who am I? What is it that I need? And how do I want to be in the world?
Yeah. Well, and I think that brings, well, there's a lot inside of what you just said. One of them is the inner conflict, of which jealousy is a huge piece. We'll get to that in a second. But I am really curious around this piece of, there tends to be, I don't know, I've heard this. Tell me what you think, because you're the expert on this, but there will be some couples that are opening or have been open for a while who don't believe in quote unquote rules, but yet you have to have agreements in order for this to work. So I'm really curious if you could just talk a little bit about that. Do you delineate between rules versus agreements? And if so, what's the difference and why do we need them?
Yeah, so I do. I talk a lot about language. I think most of my role, I primarily operate as a psychoeducator at this point. Like, that is where I love to operate. And differentiating between rules and agreements is to some extent semantics, but in another way we can think about how I can make agreements is prioritizing collaboration with the other. Rules are usually designed to keep me safe in a sort of structured, nothing could happen to me. There's this idea that somehow I could make a set of laws that will keep me safe. But as we've seen in our larger culture, laws themselves don't keep us safe. In fact, they can hurt us. They can limit us in ways that lead to major destruction. The same thing can happen inside a relationship. So an agreement is different. An agreement is something that I collaborate on creating with each individual and within the constellations of individuals that I operate, which means I need to have some processes. And one of the most common problems I see in people, especially moving from a currently monogamous structure into non-monogamy, is they don't have any tried and true, like, this is my process. This is how I make agreements. So I tend to actually teach agreements in that structured way. I teach a three-phase agreement making process so that we start from the bottom up. This is the stuff I wish we'd all learned in high school, but We didn't. And so we operate on assumption more often than not.
Very true. So is that, like, what would you say is the first step? So obviously a lot of couples contemplate this, but they just don't, or one partner in the monogamous relationship wants to start to open up, but they have no idea how to go about it. And so could you talk a little bit about what the first steps are if a couple's out there thinking about doing this?
Yeah, I think there are two important things to consider, which is one, you can want to open and not actually want to act on it. Like, you can want it in your imagination. And there is an entire imaginal exercise we can do where we start talking to our partner about inviting what I call the imaginal third into our bedroom, into our relating, where we start to fantasize and we start to operate on, like, our jealousy. We start to work on our jealousy from that imaginal place. So that's one way of opening that is often overlooked. Like, can I even tolerate this in my imagination? Then there's the practical. And I see people had one of two directions. Either they jump onto dating apps and before you could say pleasure fest, they are trashing each other or accidentally stepping way outside anybody's agreements because they don't know what they don't know, or they talk about it. And they talk about it for months that turn into years. I have frequently met with people, there are people in the year of opening who've been talking about it for decades, but not taking action because they're so frightened of what they don't know. And all of those paths, there's a next step to take from all of them. In the imaginal step, like, if I'm in the imaginal, one of us might say, okay, now I'm ready to actually take this out into the practical world. What do I do? If I'm in that step of, hey, I just want to get on dating apps. Okay, cool. Yeah. How do we make agreements that I can actually stick to? And if we've been talking about it for so long that we've never taken a step, we really need to figure out how it is that we can move the conversation into the reality. And that often takes some real courage. And one of the ways I see people getting that courage is by joining a community. Put yourself in a circumstance where this is normal and we can talk about it, because a lot of us don't have any place to talk about this at all. Or maybe we're talking, like, in a back chat room somewhere, but we don't feel really safe to talk.
Or connected or really supported, or who do you know who you're talking to? And, you know,
exactly. Yeah.
Well, and what about, because I see this happen in the couples that I've worked with where one partner wants to kind of has found an interest and they want to press the opening a little more quickly than the other partner is ready. What do you say to a couple like that?
Well, let me self-disclose here. My experience of opening started with, like, the tiniest idea of, like, oh, hey, I didn't know that was a thing people could do. And then I fell in love with someone. And I would never in a million years recommend that anyone overlook that small inkling before it's attached to a person, because once it's attached to a person, and I know this from personal experience, once it's attached to a person, you have a lot of heartache in front of you. One, you may have a partner who's like, whoa, where is this coming from? And feels like this is inspired by this other person, even though it's coming from within you. Your partner might be like, okay, cool, I'm on board, let's do some learning. But that person needs to be out of bounds now, because that feels more like an infidelity. There is so much to go through here. So I really recommend that when people are contemplating, if you are the person in your relationship who is considering this, don't wait till you've fallen for somebody. And if you have, you got to address the fact that your partner is going to have feelings about that. My first marriage ended in large part because we didn't do any preparation and just moved into action. And it became incredibly dysregulating. We didn't have the skills, we didn't have the tools, and we didn't have the container. And not all therapists were equipped to work with us. We happened to find ourselves with somebody who was not able to support us in that in-between phase. It was 15 years ago. There was very little education out there.
Yeah, sure.
So if you're in that spot, I want to give you a lot of compassion, because falling for somebody is a big deal. And it may have a really big impact on how this goes next, because it introduces jealousy as the immediate problem of interest.
Like all of a sudden, this really difficult emotion is now front and center. Whereas if you had maybe taken some time to build a foundation first, you'd have some skills for working with the jealousy, which, you know, that's an ideal situation. I think some couples, they do consider polyamory because they've met someone and they don't want to have an affair, you know,
yes,
which is never a good idea, in my opinion.
And you can absolutely work from that spot. You absolutely can.
Yeah.
But what happens is often that there needs to be a slowing down that feels very difficult from the position of the person who's like, oh, but I'm on fire here, right?
frustration.
Frustration and having to delay some of the actions that you want in order to deepen the foundations that you have with a current partner. And to be fair, it also doesn't work to... There's this common axiom in the non-monogamy world of you have to work at the pace of the slowest nervous system. You have to go at the pace of the slowest partner. And that can be problematic too, because when we have an inspiration to open, that doesn't make us wrong or bad.
Right.
And so if now I can be held hostage by a person who's saying, yep, just give me more time. And I have worked with these couples who now, 5, 6, 7 years later, they're like, okay, I've been trying to give you time and here we are. And now this is starting to feel like you don't accept me and love me as I am.
Yeah.
And so we really have to stand in the unknown, in the space between, and muddle through the difficulty of moving faster than one person maybe wants and slower than the other wants.
And I just got to say, I just give so much thanks for you for being a resource in the world for this. I just, like you said, there's more now and more therapists out there now that are getting trained in how to help couples do this, but it's still few and far between. And so I just love, and we're going to get to hear about a program that you have for couples at the end of our interview today. So listeners, everybody hang on till the end here. Let's talk about this jealousy thing, because that tends to be kind of the main thing, right? Like, oh, I could never open the relationship because I'd feel jealous. But let's talk about that, because there's also this idea that in monogamy, it's easier to kind of hide those feelings. Would you agree? And then when you do start to open, it's like, wow, we actually have to learn how to deal with these things that maybe were easier to kind of brush under the rug previously. Let's talk about jealousy. This is your area of expertise.
Yeah. I originally studied jealousy, not because I had solved it and I did not expect to find a solution. I'll just save you the trouble. We didn't find a solution. You're not going to solve it or kill it or cure it. But I researched jealousy because I'm a really jealous person. I experience a lot of jealousy as a polyamorous person. And so she wouldn't leave me alone. Jealousy was like, oh, we're dancing. Stay with me here. And when I set out to study it, I wanted to know what some of the differences were between consensually non-monogamous people and monogamous people. And so I've been studying it now for a very long time. And my comparative research has shown that the primary difference is exactly what you're pointing out. It's that monogamy, there's a little delusion present. We imagine that it will protect us from jealousy, which is ironic, because if you listen to our songs, you read our literature, you watch our movies, you read our mythology, our ancient mythologies, if you take jealousy out, we're going to lose the plot line. Like, there's no plot device as strong as jealousy for our stories. So we have to think about the ever-present nature of it. It's not going away. And monogamy doesn't protect us from it. But like you said, it can help us sweep it under the rug. And that also creates a sense of shame. And that is possibly the most challenging piece of the puzzle. Many people feel shame about jealousy in the polyamorous world, but many people also feel shame if their relationship contains jealousy.
Yeah.
If my relationship has jealousy in it, something must be wrong with my relationship.
Right, because it's one of the 7 deadly sins, quote unquote, or one of the archetypal, you know, I do a lot of Enneagram work, and that's the 4, which I happen to be a 4, envy. I don't know if you're a 4. But yeah, and like as an archetypal emotion or consciousness, we tend to deny the shadow. And yet, like you said, the shadow is never going, it's not going away. But what we can do is illuminate it and then begin to glean the wisdom from it. So I'm curious, just what is the wisdom? How do you help people find the wisdom in jealousy? What's the gem hidden within that?
Yeah, honestly, there's so much. excuse me. There's so much because the jealousy that we feel in our romantic relationships is not, it's not alone. It is not a standalone emotion. It comes packing a whole host of other emotions. Jealousy brings with it anger, sadness, shame, and envy. And let's talk for just a moment about the difference between jealousy and envy, because in American culture, at least, we tend to conflate these. We stack them together. But if we take them apart, we recognize that jealousy has great wisdom for us, because jealousy is about detecting a threat to a valued relationship. And I detect that threat in a third, right? In a real or imagined interrupter. So I can spot jealousy when I can spot the triangle. But envy can be present at the exact same time, because envy is about comparing myself to another. Well, I can compare myself to that third, downvote myself, and now I have a problem. Jealousy, when we tease it apart from envy, one, it can show us exactly who it is that we care about or we feel that we are intrinsically connected to in a survival sense, because jealousy is related to our survival instincts. It can also help us understand where our threat detection mechanism may not be serving us. Many of us have either too high or too low a threat detection system in our relationships. Really? So there's a lot that jealousy can give us. It can also be a way to build intimacy with our partnerships. If we can talk honestly about our jealousy, our partner will know us better. They really will. But that's a big task. Most people don't discuss their jealousy, and they instead either point to their partner and say, "You are making me feel jealous, so stop it."
Stop doing that thing so that I don't have to feel this uncomfortable thing.
Exactly. And we don't tend to do that with other emotions, but we have, culturally speaking, we have a negative bias against jealousy. So while yes, jealousy can be an incredibly challenging emotion to feel, although some people are attracted to it. We can bookmark that for later. Jealousy can be very, very difficult, but we have a negative bias against it. You can see it even in the APA's description of jealousy. It starts right off with a negative emotion of, and wait, just hold the phone right there. We do not say at the start of our definition for anger or sadness, a negative emotion, but wouldn't we say that anger and sadness are also hard to hold?
Right.
The bias at our societal level is so strong that then, of course, what happens to anything we have that kind of negativity bias toward? First off, we shove it into the shadow, and anything we shove into the shadow is going to come back sideways at the moment we least want it to.
Yeah.
And also, we don't actually equip ourselves. We don't teach our children how to work with this emotion. And we don't teach our professionals how to work with this emotion. My most recent study was aimed directly at helping therapists, counselors, educators understand a model to work with jealousy, because it's just missing. It's just missing from the literature in so many ways.
Wow. Well, you're working to change that, I'm sure, through your work.
Trying.
would you say I know that you have a certain single conversation that you consider to be the most important thing to reignite your sex life. Is jealousy that conversation, or is there some other single most important conversation that would?
You know, I actually think jealousy is a level 201. I think that there's a 101 question that everybody should have. If your sex life is not thriving, if you are not waking up saying this is a 9 or 10 out of 10, then my first question for all couples is, and that doesn't matter what kind of relationship, long-term, even short-term, anyone who you're going to repeatedly have sexual exchanges, intimate exchanges with, it starts with one simple question. What is sex? What is sex? And how do I know when I'm having sex? How do I know what my pleasure is? Yeah. If we can't have that conversation, and I'm sure you know, when you sit with couples, that question is so often understood to be the thing we're just supposed to know. Right. I'm just supposed to know that. We shouldn't have to talk about it.
Right. We have a lot of assumptions again, and we think it's largely just sticking something in a hole, which really that's a very limited definition of sex.
Yeah. And I've sat in rooms full of thousands of sex therapists, educators, counselors, and we have all been asked, so what is sex? Write it down on a card. Pass those cards forward. I'll tell you, there are no two definitions that are identical.
Yeah.
Every single one is unique. And that's how humans are. We experience sex, this three-letter word, as incredibly nuanced and complex and personal. And then we get together with any other person and act like they should just get it. They
Right.
should just understand our interpretation. And this is actually why I find when many people start the opening conversation, one of the big gaps is often that they didn't understand how to talk about and work with their intimacy openly in their or original relationship, because they also didn't understand how to identify and talk about this with themselves.
Wow.
And so now they want to bring in others to meet these needs, but they haven't been clear up till now. And no amount of fucking around and finding out is going to solve
yes.
that problem. It's
That's
just not,
so true.
Sadly.
What is sex? Yeah, I love that. And I can see how that is such a critical conversation to have before you open, because that is the thing that tends to differentiate a friendship from a romantic relationship, right? I wonder too, what do you feel about the conversation of what is cheating? Because people don't ever have that conversation either. And then some little thing happens and it's like, he cheated on me, but like in his mind, it wasn't cheating, or vice versa.
Yeah.
What do you think about that conversation?
Another, like, I would put that right there, like right at the beginning. The as soon as you shift a relationship into consciousness, as you start to like move from, okay, we're just gonna get together and do some stuff. As soon as you shift into any consciousness, there should be a time when you're talking about, what does it mean that we are, if we're being fidelitous, what does that mean? Cheating can happen in open relationships just as easily as it can happen in closed relationships.
Yeah,
And
let's talk about that.
Yeah, I'm sure you've seen it. Cheating is, it is nothing more than our colloquial term for betrayal.
Yeah.
We can betray each other in our friendships too. I don't have to be having sex with someone to commit a betrayal, right? Yeah. So when we're talking about our most intimate relationships, if we can have a conversation about what it means to be true to each other, what it means to be loyal to each other, what would cause harm? Right there, we have built a foundation of intimacy that I would say 90% of clients that I see haven't established that level.
Right.
And I understand the hesitation, because naming what it is that would be disloyal, that would hurt, is giving someone the instruction manual on how to hurt you. It's true. That's exactly why it's intimacy building. You're telling them, yep, you want to slash my heart. Here's how you would do
it.
And then you trust them not to.
Yeah.
And so if you are in a relationship with someone where you're like, I couldn't tell them that, they'd know exactly. Okay, you're in a bad relationship. You, like, the evidence is right in front of you. If you can't have a conversation about what betrayal is and what cheating is, you are already in a relationship that is harming you, because you don't feel that you can exchange that really deep vulnerability yet. It might just be that you're early, but if you're past the early stage and you're like, oh no, I trust this person, if you can't trust them to hold that information, I'm so worried for you. And from there, I definitely wouldn't want anyone to say, oh, well, open. Okay.
Right.
Now, often start trying to make rules that will keep them safe, because they're not willing to say in their monogamous setting, maybe they weren't willing to say exactly what was betrayal. They just use the one rule to rule them all. We're just monogamous, so you just know. And the number of people I've interviewed who are like absolutely unable to state what their fidelity agreement is in their monogamy. It's so common. So you're not alone. If this is you, you're not alone. Nobody asks us to. And that's not fair.
I agree. And I love this, because this is really the work of true intimacy. And really, when you're able to do that in your primary relationship, you're going to be so much better skilled for when you start to involve other relationships, if that is what you are intending to do. And the other thing I want to say about safety, the best definition for safety that I have ever heard from one of my teachers and mentors, Betty Martin, who I've done a lot of training with her on consent and such, I'm sure you're familiar with her work, is that safety We tend to think that safety means I'm never going to feel uncomfortable. So we're going to, in this situation here, let's create a bunch of rules so that I never have to feel these things that I don't want to feel. That is not safety. What safety actually is the ability to be in a relationship or a container, a setting, a group, where I am able to feel those uncomfortable things in a way where someone's going to be with me in that, where I know that I can actually be fully in my discomfort and I'm going to have a being with, not someone that's going to abandon or shame me or tell me not to feel that. And that, I think, inherently requires that I first be comfortable being with myself with that, that I give myself permission to feel the discomfort. And then knowing that in my relationship that there is permission and support for that discomfort to be there. That's safety. And I'm just curious, and seeing your head nod, do you want to add anything to that or just kind of take that?
I would just build into it this, that for many of us, this definitely happened for me, I lacked a sense of safety so deeply that my experience of learning safety was having someone who had safety to spare show up for me before I could actually hold it for myself.
Wow, yeah.
Showed up
awesome.
First. The thing is, I got lucky.
Yeah.
I got lucky. I would never recommend somebody go look for that.
Yeah.
My anchor partner now was able to hold my discomfort when I couldn't.
Yeah.
And I mention that only because often that's what our therapists do for us.
Right.
And that's why we go, right? Like sometimes we just need to find a single relationship where somebody can show up with that total openness to our discomfort and not run away. And
right.
From my Jungian perspective, I think also about my beloved analyst who is now passed, who also held that space, and he held it from the father archetype. He held this space of, yep, I got you. Wow, that's a lot. And I'm not going anywhere. And that let me create the space to now hold that for other people.
Yeah.
So I do believe that we can approach this from many directions, and Betty's work is par excellence. It really is.
It's pretty amazing. Yeah. Right. I love that. Right. It can be a therapist. It can be a very close friend. It can be your primary partner. But the point being is that that's the thing that helps us be able to feel safe enough within our own nervous system to then perhaps stretch a little further and maybe perhaps considering expanding the boundaries of the primary relationship to allow other relationships in.
Yeah. And you know what? Maybe this is worth exploring a little bit. I have frequently seen a phenomenon where people find that sense of embodied safety in a new person, and they don't find it in their primary partnership. And then, you know, early on in my training as a sexuality educator, someone who'd been poly for a very long time said to me, you know, the only thing you can count on is that partners will change over time. And what she was experiencing at the time was recognizing that her primary partnership was shifting, and she was having to work with that. Like, what does this mean? And sometimes when we talk about opening, the focus is on protecting this intact primary a priori couple. And a lot of opening is about opening up to the idea that most of us experience change in our relationships over a lifetime. Opening doesn't actually make it more risky than not opening. What makes it risky is when we can't tolerate change, and then we experience life happening to us, and that can impact any of our relationships. So I've seen a lot of people experience that being heldness, being seenness in their newer partner,
right?
And not recognize that, you could transfer that skill. All of your relationships could up level because now you have experienced something new.
Yeah.
And, but that takes sort of a divesting from the idea that a primary partnership has to be everything, and it has to be first, and it has to be the best at everything,
which takes
a lot of maturity.
It really does. And that's sort of how I've looked at that idea is can that relationship, really any relationship that wants to really grow and last, it has to be it has to be able to withstand the changes that happen and adjust to those changes and grow with it, because people do change and grow, and the relationship also has to change and grow. And I think that is really complicated because not everybody's willing to grow in the same way or at the same time, and that's okay. That can be okay too, but I see that a lot of times bring a relationship down. relationships end because of that, because one partner is just not ready to grow and the other partner is, and the relationship itself just can't survive that.
And I love the concept of just introducing, can we tolerate our partnerships not being on the same page for a while? Can we tolerate the fact that, so I talk a lot about individuation-oriented relationships,
Yeah, I was going to
relationships
ask you
that are,
about that.
yeah,
Sorry about
when
that.
they're designed specifically around the concept that I'm going to show up for your growth, which means you may grow in a different direction. You may grow at a different pace that might be slower, faster than me. And I am going to be present to the fact that that's your growth process. And
Yeah.
it's not a personal statement about my worth. That, again, takes an immense amount of maturity. And I have to then hold myself in the discomfort of watching my partner grow in ways that feels like, ah, we're not just like together in our tiny little couple bubble and everything's perfect. And again, not about opening. This is about, can I be with my partner as a truly autonomous individual having their own life and also experience intimacy? So we have to be able to differentiate, and we
Yeah.
have to be able to tolerate the experience of those times when, wow, I do not feel how we are in that growth path together.
Yeah.
It's not a small thing, but it is a totally game-changing way to be in your relationship.
I agree with that. I think from my perspective, how I might define that, it's really the practice of love. You know, love is really not about keeping something the same. As long as you're this way, I feel love and I'm in love. It's really about our capacity to stretch our hearts and stretch our capacity to totally accept somebody where they're at and the way they are, including accepting ourselves where we're at and where we are. And then being able to be in the dance with that. Like that to me is really, it's the living practice of love or one aspect of it.
Yeah, the love is a verb, right? Love is a verb. It is our actions. Bell hooks talking about cathexis. Yes, yes to all of that. I would totally upvote what you just said.
Yeah, awesome. What about, so sometimes couples think that opening up is the solution to the challenges that they're having. They're convinced that if I could just have other lovers and you were okay with it, like I would be giving you all the attention you want and need because then I'd be happy having this thing I want over here. That's a myth, right?
It's, I mean, obviously that is usually a feeling held by one half of an intact couple, right? It is often not two people who are like, yes, everything, we're not happy, but we'll be happy if we both have other lovers. Because in that case, actually, there's not a problem. They're usually like, okay, actually, we just kind of want to diversify our love. And usually there is no struggle. But if there's currently a struggle or there's a gap or there's something that doesn't feel right, one person may see the solution as opening. Maybe the other comes along and is like, okay, I can kind of see your point. Let's see, I'll diversify our love portfolio a little bit. But all the troubles, it's actually exactly like divorcing someone while still having children. All the problems you had before, they're not going away, and you still have to co-parent with that person. I say that as a person who co-parents with people I was once married to. It is incredibly eye-opening to experience things like new intimacy, falling in love, or even just having new sexual experiences with people. Like you might not even be going all the way into the realm of polyamory and deep emotionality. Maybe you're going to play in the waters of swinging. Yeah, all your new experiences. If you couldn't talk about stuff before, now you have new stuff you can't talk about. There is the exception to that rule. Every once in a while, I find a couple who says, yeah, we were mostly just bored. We didn't know what to talk about. So this gave us stuff. This gave us material to talk about. And so those people, if what you're experiencing is primarily a sense of, yeah, we've kind of explored everything. We don't know what to do next. We're just kind of complacent with each other. Opening up can be the catalyst for, yes, some trouble. But I think of it as the good trouble of, yeah, what happens when you start seeing each other as individuals again and you start having stuff to work on? And then it can really draw people deeper into conversation. I recently worked with a couple in the year of opening who they were prom king, prom queen. They literally came into my office described, they're like, nothing bad has ever happened to us. And they like everything in their life just went exactly as it was supposed to. Everything was good. And they were in their late 50s, early 60s, respectively. They're like, we want to know each other more. So they spent the year exploring opening, and yeah, it ruffled feathers. It caused discussions and disagreements, but it also created energy where there had been just this sort of lulled into almost a living death state. So there are those exceptions to the rule. And I think it's they need a shout out too, because they exist. And I think they often don't get heard. We hear the negative stories, but they've had a beautiful opening process of like, yeah. So we had a big fight over that. And then we used our repair tools and we checked in and we're great. We're better than we ever were.
Oh, I mean, that's beautiful. And that's really what we're after, right? Well, let's talk about, so you have this program called the Year of Opening, and this is like your signature offer to help couples out there that are listening to this show, perhaps right now, that maybe have been thinking about opening, or maybe they've opened and it's been a train wreck, or maybe they've opened and it's been great, but they just don't know the landscape. So can you talk about this program? What's in it? How does it work and who's it for?
Yeah. Well, first, I got to address the elephant that comes into the room whenever I say the name of the program. It really is a year long. I ask people to commit a full year to the experience because there's, like, as we've been discussing, there's so much to unpack. There's so much to learn about yourself, so much to learn about the people that you're already interacting with. Some people come in partnered, many of them, a lot of them are couples already partnered opening, but people also come in from that position of like, well, I've done the serial monogamy thing and I would like to open, but I don't know how to do this well. And I don't want to just go do destructive testing. So we spend a whole year together. I used to do primarily private coaching. And so I'd be working with people. And what I noticed is in the private coaching space, they would work on what came up. And so basically they wouldn't get to the next problem, even though I would introduce these questions to ask, they wouldn't get to the next problem area until it was already a problem for them.
Oh, wow.
I shifted into group work because in community where we start normalizing like, oh, open relating in its many various forms from swinging to monogamish all the way into relationship anarchy and polyamory, those are all things that we can just talk about. So we normalize that talking and then we work through a curriculum together, but it's a very alive thing. Like I live teach. It's not a course because we all know. Nobody finishes courses.
Yeah.
Nobody finishes courses. So we talk about it. And there's magic that happens when you watch somebody making a relational move and you're like, oh, I think I see what's going to, oh no. Oh, it is happening that way. Oh, that's okay. I'm glad that one didn't happen to me. Or when you see somebody take the risk, jump off the cliff and it turns out they fly. Like we don't get to see the inside of other people's relationships very often.
Oh, I love this. Yeah.
So yeah, there's small groups, 20 people capped per cohort. There are 4 cohorts that run a year and we bond together. And I love that opportunity.
I love that. I really have to do a shout out for the group format. And I think a lot of times with these really sensitive areas like sexuality, open relationship, your intimate relationship, people tend to think like, well, I could never talk about that around other people. There's too much shame or pride. But yet the group is so powerful because for the very reason you just said, we get to see the lives of other people. We get to learn from that. We get to see the successes, the failures. You get that mastermind download that is just not quite the same when it's, you know, more of a one-on-one setting. And then I think you can progress actually much more quickly in that kind of a setting as well, potentially.
Yeah, that's exactly what I see. What I wind up seeing is people make faster progress and they also come out of it with a group of people who you're going to have bonded with. And you're not going to, like, everyone's not going to be your best friend, but everybody finds their spot. Like, oh, I know where to reach. And the groups, like, we stay together. And that, it reminds me of the people who I parented with in the early days. Like, we don't have to be best friends in each other's pockets now that our children are grown, but they were there when it all started. And nobody knows your story like they know your story. That is remarkably different from just going it alone and not being witnessed. There's magic also in being witnessed.
Absolutely.
I applied a repair skill. Like, where can I celebrate that? Like I did an Imago dialogue. Woohoo!
Well, who should and should not? I mean, is there some criteria that a couple might use if they're thinking about opening? Should all couples just go for it? Or there's some that maybe it's not really right for?
You know, I think anyone is capable of doing the moves. However, I think if you are currently doing deep trauma work, I would encourage you to do that deep trauma recovery work for at least a year before you dive into opening. I have worked with people who are doing that in a simultaneous sense, and they often need a second ear. Often what happens is they start learning about opening, they start taking steps, and they realize, oh, this is really hard. And it's not, it's often the person who in a relationship who has experienced a lot of trauma who wants to open, but then it like can't bear it. It's like just a lot for their body to take.
Right.
So I encourage you to really dig into that work for a good solid year or more before taking the steps to take active opening. That said, you know, some of the success stories are the ones that surprised me the most. The people who, when they showed up, were like, I don't know that I want this. They were what we might call poly under duress. They were being introduced to non-monogamy. And I also call them the reluctant partner, because they're reluctant to the idea of non-monogamy, but they can get into self-consent. And so here's who absolutely should consider opening. All the people who can get into a self-consent mindset, like, yes, I can consent to be in exploration. I can consent to learning about my own needs, wants, desires, and boundaries. I can consent to setting those boundaries and holding them in the face of my partner's discomfort. And I can consent to talking about building intimacy. If you can just get into consent about doing those, you don't have to be able to do them yet. But if you can actually show up to like, yes, I am here for that. And I'm willing to be uncomfortable at times.
Yeah,
go for it. You're ready. Jump in with both feet.
And, you know, because that is such not the conversation that most people are having with themselves. When you don't like that right there, those three pieces, areas of consent. I mean, if we thought about it that way, it completely changes the whole nature of the conversation we're having. Because I think where people tend to go is, can I imagine my partner having sex with someone else? And that's it's too many steps ahead.
So many steps. Like that is jumping off the high dive board. And some people do that. And what they find out is, oh, I can totally manage that. Awesome. I must be great at being open. And then their partner falls in love with someone and they find out, oh, wait, I'm terrible at this. I can't do it. Let's pull the plug. They find out that they can, they really do thrive, but it turns out their partner who initiated all this opening is really struggling with the opening process. That happens. I call that the flip.
Wow.
Lots of people experience like, I'm the woo-woo, let's go partner. And then 6 months in, but wait, I have to watch my partner do what? I have to be, wait, I was in this for what I could get out of it. And I'm not ready for them to have that. And so there's so much unpacking to do there.
Yeah.
To create agreements that actually work for these diverse nervous systems and psyches to actually experience opening.
And I love that because this is really, it's a lot of what I do with my couples as well and in different capacity, but it's really building a skill set that becomes the foundation so that you can navigate freely.
Yeah.
For moving forward really for a lifetime. If you have that skill set there, that's something that you will always have. You can always get better at it. It's never something that will be taken away. You can always draw on that, which is much different than just advice or tips or not having any skills at all, trial and error.
Yeah. I frequently tell people I love that we have so many books now. I love that we do. I'm so grateful. I wish that I'd had them when I was opening 15 years ago. Oh my gosh. But a lot of times people have come in and they've read the books and they're trying to do that, but they're not practicing the skills. They're not then saying, okay, I need to take this skill and insert it into my daily life. And that's again, where community can help support us in, you know, you show up and you say, well, we fought about this damn thing again. And somebody can say, so then did you do an apology and accountability ladder? Did you do it? No. Oh, okay. Did you have a dialogue about it? No. Did you do anything? No. Okay. It's good to be witness where we're not showing up for the actual skill development. Because you're right. Once you've developed the skills, nobody can take that away from you.
Right. You just have to use them. And that's
Have to use them. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, beautiful. Why don't you tell our listeners how can people get in on this course, this year of opening, and how can they connect with you beyond the show today?
Well, if you're thinking about opening, what I recommend is going to joliquiz.com, JOLIQUIZ.com. It's a 10-question quiz. It's based out of my research, and it's designed to help you figure out, like, where am I in my readiness to open? Can I open up happily? Not everybody's ready, and that's okay. You might be at the stage where you need foundations. Take the quiz. From there, you'll be invited to join me for a free salon where I talk about the five pillars of successful open relating. I hold that every month, and I love having the opportunity to teach people these foundational premises, the ones that are even beyond what we just covered here. And you can follow me on social media as well at Dr. Jolie_Hamilton.
Awesome. And I will put all those resources in the show notes so our listeners can click on that and get in touch with Dr. Jolie Hamilton. It has been so much fun having you, Jolie. Thank you so much for being my guest today on the Sex Talk Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me, Susan.
Thank you for joining me today for the Sex Talk Cafe. Please be sure to show your support by subscribing to this podcast and sharing it with your friends. To keep in the loop on future events and happenings, and to grab your copy of our free ebook, The Pleasure Keys, 7 Secrets to Feminine Sexual Fulfillment, visit us online at pathwaytopleasure.com.